What is the most important e-discovery issue today?
Cost control?
Technology-assisted review?
Information management?
Preservation?
From the latest cases to the newest technologies.
Our goal is to expose legal professionals to the most important e-discovery trends
with the brightest e-discovery experts.
Rulemaking,
predictive coding,
litigation hold,
proportionality,
document review,
social media,
efficiency,
ethics,
cooperation. Welcome to the ESI Report, sponsored by Kroll On Track, an e-discovery software and service provider. You are listening to the Legal Talk Network.
Hi, I'm Michelle Lang, and welcome to the ESI Report. It's not very often that judges write specifically about technology-assisted review or predictive coding, but when they do, it's important for all of us in e-discovery to take notice, as these opinions tend to show that the judiciary is becoming more comfortable talking about the technology and the processes associated with TAR. Today's podcast will include an in-depth examination into the inner workings of an investigation leveraging predictive coding and technology-assisted review. Joining me today are Cliff Nichols and Tony Reichenberger, TAR experts who were both involved in the case at hand. Cliff Nichols is an e-discovery counsel for Day Pitney, where he directs all electronic investigation. A regular speaker at eDiscovery conferences and events, Cliff is recognized as a leader in the cost-saving and efficient use of predictive coding and other types of technology-assisted review. Tony Reichenberger is an advanced review services team manager at Kroll On Track, where he manages document review projects and consults with clients on predictive coding and technology-assisted review. It's great to have two experts here on the phone with us today for the ESI Report. Cliff and Tony, thanks so much for joining me.
Hello, Michelle. Thanks for having me.
Glad to be here, Michelle.
So, Tony, let's go ahead and get started. Can you give us a bit of an overview of TAR and predictive coding for our listeners? Perhaps describe each term and how they differ and why e-discovery professionals need to care.
I'll be glad to, Michelle. We seem to be at a point where clear definitions of these terms are now understood by e-discovery practitioners and judges, and most now feel comfortable in what is being described when we say predictive coding or TAR, technology-assisted review, which is also sometimes referred to as CAR or computer-assisted review. Technology-assisted review is a broader term that describes a process for prioritizing or coding a collection of documents using a computerized system that takes the human judgments of a SME, of a subject matter expert on a particular matter, applies it, takes it to a smaller set, and then extrapolates those judgments across the remaining population. Many vendors have varying features within their respective tools that conceptually falls under the umbrella of technology-assisted review. For instance, it can include prioritization of documents based on topic grouping, concept searching, coding documents by a duplicate sync, email threading. There are a number of different features. TAR cases often incorporate some sort of statistical model or sampling technique to guide the process and provide metrics on the completeness of the relevant set of what you're looking for. Predictive coding, by contrast, is a narrower term in that it is a specific kind of technology-assisted review. The best description I've seen comes right out of the Grossman-Cormack glossary, which is that predictive coding is used to describe a TAR process involving the use of a machine learning algorithm to distinguish relevant from non-relevant documents. This could refer to either the automatic prioritization of documents by the algorithm or their suggestion as relevant or non-relevant. Both TAR and predictive coding in particular can increase the quality, increase efficiency in a review, and save considerable time and money. With review being the most costly portion of e-discovery, the savings can be substantial and the quality of the production is notably better. I've used TAR on a number of reviews now, and the quality is substantially noteworthy.
So, you know, it's not very often that lawyers talk about the details of a case that they worked on. But in this case that we're going to talk about today, both of you are involved in this case, the New Mexico State Investment Council versus Bland. And much of the information about the predictive coding processes was out there in the public domain. Cliff, can you perhaps give us a brief background into the case, some of its challenges, and how you knew that TAR and predictive coding were the right options for getting through this document set?
Sure thing, Michelle. At its heart, our case is about greed and corruption. Our client, the New Mexico State Investment Council, or the SIC, is a state agency that is charged with investing and growing a large pot of money that exists for the benefit of the people of New Mexico. It's the people's money. And we allege in our complaint that the former head of the agency presided over a scheme whereby he and his conspirators funneled millions of dollars to politically connected people. As a part of the scheme, investment groups that wanted the SIC to invest in their funds understood that they had to enter into agreements with these people and pay them to, quote, introduce them to the state agency. One of the agreements I'm talking about provided for a payment of $2 million just in exchange for contact information at the SIC. It's good work if you can get it, and as they say, it's great to know people in high places. Anyway, so with hundreds of potential defendants and a relevant period that spanned over 6 years, we knew there could be a ton of data, both from our client and from the hundreds of other sources that we could draw upon. Fortunately, the SEC had already conducted an investigation here, and they had collected documents from over 135 parties via their subpoena power. Because we were appointed Special Assistant Attorneys General for the state of New Mexico, we were able to get access to the SEC's file. We learned it was massive. Early on, we identified the producing parties that were most likely to have relevant data we'd be interested in, and still there were 2.5 million pages or so of documents that we needed to review. We thought of search terms, the more traditional approaches to filtering data, but we literally had thousands of terms, including hundreds of proper names, that just would have to be part of any search due to the huge nature of our investigation. It wasn't going to work. So we looked at predictive coding. You remember, this is 2011. There was no judicial guidance at all. There was no De Silva Moore case. There were no treatise articles that I was aware of. The technology was brand new to the legal profession. As most lawyers are, we were cautious, but we really had no other choice. I'd worked with Kroll on many projects over the years, and we approached you about trying out this newfangled thing. So together, Tony and I set up a plan that allowed us to begin a traditional style review of the 2.5 million pages that we could then incorporate predictive coding in later after we saw how it worked and decide whether or not we could rely on it. With that plan in place, we jumped in.
So after you decided to use technology-assisted review to sift through this vast amount of data, this 2.6 million documents, Tony, what were some of the first steps in implementing predictive coding? How did you begin the review efforts, and how did you help Cliff and his team become more comfortable with the technology?
As Cliff mentioned, when the matter came to us, this was Mr. Nichols' first time using the predictive coding feature with Kroll OnTrack. And as he also mentioned, there were no industry standards at the time to help guide us as far as what we were doing. So we used a relatively conservative approach. We used a larger sample set that included family members that also helped train the system. He wanted to get a feel for how it worked, what needed to be done, what decisions had to be made. And until he felt comfortable using the feature, we were fine letting it work somewhat in the background as a normal, typical review process began. We started by completing that random sample set while the reviewers began review. Cliff began on a sample and training the system, and once he felt comfortable with the review team decisions, some of the training was delegated to a select couple of reviewers that he felt particularly comfortable with. One of the great things about predictive coding is that it gives you great insight into the database. The better the system is trained, the more accurate those insights are.
Once the sample was complete and the learning session done, we had very favorable metrics and suggestions. As an example, the suggested total of responsive documents in the database was 20,889. When we completed review, the actual total was 19,579, which is only a difference of 0.47% of the database as a whole. We also used predictive coding to identify potential documents to QC, documents that were basically conflicting in their coding and their suggestion. And when we showed those documents to Mr. Nichols, he was impressed with how well the algorithm caught very subtle relevant material that was originally missed by a reviewer. We also provided Cliff with the probability breakdown of the database, and he sampled the suggestions on the documents themselves, largely approving of how the documents were being suggested and for which categories those applied to.
So, Cliff, perhaps you can talk a little bit about the court's response to the use of predictive coding in this investigation. What did the judge say? How was it received? What did your opposing party think of it?
Well, as you said at the outset, Michelle, it's not often that our discovery or investigative practices become open to the public, but let me explain how that happened here. There's a key TAM plaintiff involved in the case, and he's essentially a whistleblower. On behalf of the state, he had previously brought suit against some of the defendants we named in our case, and the judge let him intervene in our case. So when we entered into settlements with some of the defendants, he objected. Consequently, under statute, the court had to determine whether the settlements were fair and reasonable, and a part of this is an evaluation of the investigation that we conducted. The relevant statute allowed for an evidentiary hearing, so our process became the subject of public display. I submitted an affidavit, and I took the witness stand at the hearing. After hearing all the evidence, the judge issued a decision finding that our investigation met the applicable standard and that our use of the technology, our use of predictive coding and other tools had led to a more accurate and efficient review. And I think that this is a very important conclusion.
And just to clarify a little bit, Cliff, this work that you guys talked about was done mostly in 2011, but the judge's opinion just came out in 2014?
Well, we had many separate databases in this case. This is only one 2.5 million page database. We actually had two others that were of similar size that we gained access to throughout the years that this investigation took. However, all of that work that we did was subject to the judge's determination as to whether our investigation was sufficient to meet the standard. And it was looked at in light of the developing standards and how we view discovery and investigation today.
So, Tony, you've worked on dozens, if not hundreds, of document review matters throughout your career, and many of them now in modern times with predictive coding. What are some of the things that stood out to you about this particular case that you worked on with Cliff Nichols and his firm? And what are some of the things that you have learned that you perhaps are carrying forward into other cases that you'll work on in the future?
The biggest thing about this case that I carry forward is that getting a client familiar with predictive coding and the review tool is important not just for the matter at hand, but for future matters. Most first-time clients I've dealt with in regard to predictive coding are a little skeptical, a little apprehensive, until they kind of jump in with both feet. It's largely out of sight, out of mind. They really don't want to make a mistake, which is very understandable. Sometimes that means just setting it up and letting it work in the background of a review until the client gets used to it. Getting clients to not only see the process, but to take an active interest in getting the algorithm to where it needs to be and seeing the results is paramount. Comparing the suggestions to what was anticipated, you know, it's very important. For that reason, walking them through the sampling, preferably clients should be the ones training the system. They're the experts on their own matter. They know what's relevant and what's not relevant. Walking them through that process and training, additional training to help improve the metrics, seeing the process, demonstrating where the metrics you are using coming from, how they're quantified, showing samples of documents with varying probabilities so the client can get a sense as to what the algorithm is doing very well and what it still might need work on, helping clients run searches using suggestions so they can feel confident in their own use of predictive coding, not just on the current matter, but going forward. In most of my cases, once someone sees how it works and sees different ways in which it can be utilized in a review, and then they start to think about how much time and money can be saved, not just on this review, but on every review, they use predictive coding on future cases and become very, very savvy at its use. You know, there's multiple ways to use this technology as opposed to just cutting out document review. For instance, when you receive an adverse party's production, taking those documents and loading them into the same database and applying all of your hard work training your database against the opposing party's production is a great way to leverage the technology. And the more people who use the technology, the more people they understand how those different processes can work and what they can use it for. I'm very happy to say that Mr. Nichols is an excellent example of someone who really understands how to use predictive coding on matters and different ways it can enhance the review and cut costs.
I'm definitely an example of a convert to the process. As Tony said, we our toes at first because I had never used it before. My firm had never used it before. The client didn't even know what it was at the time. Since then, we've conducted many large investigations and discovery responses, and I think I've used some form of predictive coding on every one of those projects, whether it was to filter the data at the outset and determine what documents we were going to review, or whether we were using it to identify potentially hot or key documents early in the process and get those to our internal lawyers as soon as possible. It's a great tool, and I continue to use it.
So, Cliff, maybe you could add on a little bit more and talk about some of the things that lawyers should take away from this opinion. If you were an attorney reading this opinion, what can be learned from what you experienced with this implementation of predictive coding and technology-assisted review? And what are some of the key takeaways that folks perhaps that have never used it should be alerted of?
Well, as I said, it was 2011, so we had little guidance to go by. We weren't trying to meet a discovery response at that time, so we didn't have to necessarily concern ourselves about whether or not this was a reasonable search under the rules, the standard of rules. But we did have to conduct an appropriate investigation to sufficiently apprise ourselves of the facts. We were unsure that that was going to happen at the outset, but as we moved through each custodian, we became more and more trusting in what the tool can do as we saw that it was working. The amount of relevant documents would just drop like a rock as we moved through each of the custodians' data. We sampled thousands of predicted non-responsive documents and found almost nothing of interest in the documents the machine said we could ignore. When we reached a point where the system would run out of suggested responsive documents, we learned we could just move on to another custodian. It got to the point where I was really looking forward to that because I knew I'd get back to more interesting documents after days or a week of uninteresting predicted non-responsive documents. Also, I really did learn the value of expert guidance. I've used predictive coding, as I said, on dozens of projects now, and our success is directly related to the quality of the people that are working on the project. That means both the vendor partners that I'm working with and the reviewing attorneys that are training the documents. One of the ironies of predictive coding is that it's very dependent on people and their expertise. It's not a machine takeover or a magic black box type technology. It learns from humans. It extrapolates their expertise over millions of pages of documents. People are still doing the work. There's just few billable hours, which everyone loves. So in our case here, although the judge didn't provide any specific analysis of our process in the decision, I think it's extremely important that she was willing to accept our use of the technology and to conclude that our work met the standard. We simply could not have done a linear review of this database. The numbers were too great. Predictive coding has entered the judicial lexicon at this point, and you know they're not afraid to start using these words. Predictive coding, TAR, technology-assisted review. I think we'll find more and more decisions going forward that reference the use of this technology, and there'll be little or no fanfare about it and little discussion because it's going mainstream. If you're sitting on the fence and you want to use the tool, there are now 8 or 9 judicial decisions out there that you can point to and try to assess the reasonableness in light of your case. This one here, Nimzik v. Bland, it says it worked. If you want to use it for an internal investigation, you want to use predictive coding for an internal investigation, you can point to this decision as support that you used accepted practices to identify relevant information in a limited amount of time. If you want to use it to meet discovery demands, you can reference this decision to support a proportional cost-benefit analysis that shows that predictive coding can be a reasonable search and that it's more efficient than a standard linear review. If you want to force an opposing party to conduct a review that they say is too onerous and too burdensome, you can suggest that predictive coding be used to limit the cost and thus make the burden lower. As a whole, I think judges have become much more comfortable with this technology and other types of technology than most lawyers. And we need to take advantage of that. Our clients expect us to bring these kind of solutions to the table, and I think that predictive coding should be a real significant part of that.
Well, I think that's a perfect place to wrap it. Thank you, Cliff. Thank you, Tony. This was a great in-depth case study of, I'm going to cite the case again, New Mexico State Investment Council versus Bland, and it will be available on ediscovery.com under the Resources tab and then under Case Studies. So if any of our listeners would like to go out and read a little bit more, some of the more details that Cliff and Tony talked about, it is available on ediscovery.com. Cliff and Tony, thank you so much for being on the ESI Report.
My pleasure, Michelle. Happy to have been here.
Thanks for having me, Michelle.
Well, and that wraps up another edition of the ESI Report. Thank you to everyone listening, and thanks to Kroll on Track for sponsoring the show. If you want, make sure you are in the eDiscovery know. Check out the new eDiscovery.com website. There's something there for everyone, including this very interesting case study. Until next time, I'm Michelle Lang, signing off for the ESI Report.
This was another edition of the ESI Report, sponsored by Kroll on Track. Be sure to follow Kroll on Track on Facebook and Twitter, or learn more about Kroll on Track software and services at www.krolontrack.com. Thanks for listening to the ESI Report, produced by the broadcast professionals at Legal Talk Network. Join Michelle Lang for her next podcast on the latest e-discovery trends. Subscribe to the RSS feed on LegalTalkNetwork.com or in iTunes. The views expressed by the participants of this program are their own and do not represent the views of, nor are they endorsed by, Legal Talk Network, its officers, directors, employees, agents, representatives, shareholders, and subsidiaries. None of the content should be considered legal advice. As always, consult a lawyer.